Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Hi, welcome to today's Connecting Faith. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Neil Statham, and thanks to Nate Grizzle, who's been sitting in for Ted Ross on vacation this week. So hats off, Nate. Appreciate that. Carissa's at the phones, ready to take your calls. We've got some copies of our book Focus today to give away, and I think you'll want to join the conversation. I hope you will. You know, we've had quite a week. I'm thinking about, you know, the headlines in the news, and they can often lead to discouragement. We talked about refugees Monday and yesterday, talking about ISIS, and you know, that's just, you know, some of the challenges that we run into, and often feel that maybe God has left the building and we're on our own. But we have some good news that we're going to talk about today as we highlight a book called Restoring All Things, God's Audacious Plan to Change the World Through Everyday People. And I know you're going to be encouraged by our conversation. I'll get today's guest on in a moment. I do want to just mention, too, that we're drawing to a close our partnership with FEBC. During the month of June, we've been inviting your participation to share the gospel message through radio. FEBC is providing solar-powered radios, handheld radios, to individuals that are in remote areas across Asia. And for your gift of $30, you can place a radio into the hands of someone who will use it to hear God's word. And on average, each radio will reach 25 people or more with the gospel. And we've got a link on our website. The goal for this this month, this partnership, has been 400 radios placed. And we're, I think, you know, a little over a third of the way there. So if you're willing to join in with us, maybe a $100 gift or something here during the month of June, that would go a long way toward advancing God's kingdom through radio at FEBC. You can get details online, myfaithradio.com. So, and thanks in advance for that, myfaithradio.com. Let me introduce our guest today, John Stonestreet. You hear John fairly regularly on Breakpoints during Austin Hill in the morning. That's kind of must listening for me every day. John Eric does such a great job. And John is one of the teachers at the Summit Ministries, and he is a sought-after speaker and a leader. He's co-authored the book Making Sense of Your World, A Biblical Worldview. Recently wrote The Same-Sex Marriage, A Thoughtful Approach to God's Design for Marriage. A speaker and fellow with the Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview, and the voice of two nationally syndicated radio commentaries, Breakpoint and then The Point. And Breakpoint Weekend, I guess, right, John? That's your regular gig, isn't it, Breakpoint Weekend?
Yeah, Breakpoint this week. Yeah, that's the name of it. It's an interview-based show every weekend. And, just one of the three radio programs we produce out of the Colson Center.
Yeah, I try and listen every week just to figure out who I can have for future guests. So thanks for doing all my legwork for me, John. Really appreciate it.
You bet.
The new book you've co-written with Warren Cole Smith from Vice President of World News Group, called Restoring All Things, God's Audacious Plan to Change the World Through Everyday People. It's a good read, and I'm interested to know, just full of lots of stories, a realistic look at the culture in which we live, but also really hopeful stories about how there are, you know, men and women really making a difference, having an impact. And I'm interested to know, I guess, maybe if the book came about, if it's to encourage believers that we can make a difference, or if you kind of had in mind maybe the skeptics that don't think Christian faith is really adding value to society.
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, but primarily this is a book for believers. I mean, when, last year when Sean McDowell and I worked through a book called Same-Sex Marriage, and we put that out in light of the kind of the huge cultural shifts we were seeing on the definition of marriage, one of the things that it just became super obvious is that for many people, this was one of the issues, and maybe even the primary issue, that led people to kind of see their cultural moment, through a lens of really great despair. I mean, I even had a pastor look at me and say, "John, it's over. We've lost." And I remember hearing that and thinking, "Well, wait a minute. Who's we that have lost? You know, and what's it that's over? I mean, the kingdom of God isn't over. There's not a Supreme Court decision that's going to put Jesus back in the grave." And it's very tempting, I think, for Christians in particular, to see that a cultural moment as kind of the story of the world. But the story of the world is the story that we get out of Scripture, the creation of all things to the new creation of all things, from the heavens and earth to the new heavens and new earth, centered around Jesus Christ, who rose from the dead. And so death has no victory, you know. That's it. That's what the Apostle Paul says, that this is the center of reality, that Christ is risen. And so what we were hoping to do is kind of remind people that we live in a cultural moment, and it's real, and it's significant, and there's some very crazy things happening, but the truth of the world that will never change, and that should drive our existence in this cultural moment, is that Christ is risen from the dead, and that the eternal story of redemption, where, you know, John the Apostle puts in the mouth, quotes in the, from the mouth of Jesus, you know, "Behold, I make all things new," that's actually going to happen, right? And that's actually, we live in that tension between, you know, what many people have called, you know, D-Day and V-Day. You know, D-Day secures the victory, but V-Day is still coming. And so we need to live in that great hope, not in despair. And so really, we were trying to call Christians back to that. To that sense of hope and you know, living out of the kind of the gospel truth.
As I was reading through the book, and by the way, we've got some copies to give away, and I know you'd find it encouraging and really helpful in just helping you maybe just to focus on ways that you can be the salt and light and be the ambassadors that, that God has called all of us to be. You give us a call at 877-93-FAITH to sign up for a drawing for that here at the end of the show. 877-933-2484. I was thinking as I was reading stories, because they're full of many examples, and as we'll cover some of the bigger issues, the big cultural maybe drivers of the day, but I was thinking we often have gotten used to, or it seems like we get focused on the big picture solutions. It's, you know, government solutions, macro issues, and the story has had a lot of sort of micro, I guess, the individuals making a difference. And you you address Tocqueville's assessment about America and that important middle ground. Talk about that.
Well, you know, I think a lot of time has been spent over the last couple decades, you know, in terms of Christian engagement of culture, complaining and yelling and screaming at the top, what I call the top of culture. In other words, what's happening in D.C. and Hollywood. And trust me, there's plenty to scream at, and there's plenty to be concerned about. And I'm not saying we should be silent about those things at all, particularly those Christians who have been called into those spheres of influence. I mean, there's remarkable people, you know, in Hollywood, for example, like Mark Burnett or you know, others that are trying to live out their faith in that environment. And then you have people, of course, in D.C. as well. But most of us don't live there. And while we should know what's happening there, a lot of times our kind of sending all of our attention to the top of culture has actually distracted us from doing what we can do where we are. And that's what we call aiming for the middle. And I think it's biblical, you know, whatever your hand finds to do, you know, do it with all of your might, Paul says, you know, to him who knows to do good and he doesn't do it, to him it is a sin. And, you know, and I think, you know, that kind of informs the fact that we should do anything we can do. And if we're getting distracted by watching, you know, maybe too much of the news about how bad everything is and then getting really upset about things we have no control over, it's going to keep us from doing things that we actually can do where we do have some control. But it also goes to kind of you know, something that comes out of that masterful analysis of the American experiment in the 1800s from Alexis de Tocqueville. And he came over and of course talked about, you know, what he had seen in his book Democracy in America. He said a lot of different things, but one of the things he said that made America so, you know, exceptional was that America was so strong in its middle. And what he meant by that is that it, you know, wasn't that it had this, you know, strong government or that, you know, there were these kind of, you know, superhero individuals. It's that in between the big government and individuals was a very robust middle, a set of mediating structures like family and church and voluntary associations and so on. If you listen to the current political debate, we're basically given a choice between, you know, big government solving our problems, you know, Supreme Court ruled today upholding, you know, the health care plan from, you know, President Obama and so on. You know, big government deserves, you know, to have the opportunity to solve all of our problems. And then on the political right, we often hear kind of a libertarian individualism. You know, everyone should have autonomous individual freedom. Well, we know that, you know, when big government doesn't have its power checked, it gets out of control. We also know that if individuals are not virtuous, then their freedom leads to vice. Their freedom leads even to anarchy and oppression. And so, you know, an individual by himself cannot sustain his own freedom unless he has the ability to self-govern. And the institutions that teach us and cultivate us and curate in us an ability to be virtuous are these mediating institutions. And great political thinkers like Edmund Burke and of course, de Tocqueville's talking about this as well, looking at the strength of the family, the strength of the local church, the strength of local government. I know some of us think, man, I wish we could get some of those billions of dollars we spent on the last presidential election and invest in, you know, city council races and school boards. I mean, that would make an enormous difference. And so what we're doing in the book is calling people's attention back to the middle. And then we tell stories of Christians, Christians all over America. I mean, we all know the stories of Wilberforce and Bonhoeffer, and these are wonderful stories to know. But it's easy for us to say, well, I'm no Wilberforce, I'm no Bonhoeffer. Well, you read the stories in Restoring All Things, and Warren Smith is my co-author, a wonderful storyteller for World Magazine. World does an amazing job of telling the stories of Christians who are bringing hope and redemption to issues that government actually can't effectively address. And you learn these stories and you think to yourself, oh my goodness, there's a lot of hope left, right? I mean, there's Christians that are changing lives in everyday communities. And we hope that that instructs us about the sort of things that we ought to care about. I hope it instructs us about the sort of things that we can do about those things. And I hope it inspires us to go and do likewise. And that's really the power, I think, of these stories. And there are, you know, we deal with 14 or 15 different areas of culture and tell four or five stories in each chapter. And like I said, we left a lot of stories on the table that we couldn't even bring to the book because there really is a lot of Christians who understand, you know, what it means to be a restorative force in the middle of society. And they're doing just incredible things.
And we'll tell some of those stories and hear more from John Stone Street, learning a lot already in our conversation. John Stone Street, speaker and fellow with the Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview. And he's the voice on the Breakpoint, the radio commentary with Eric Metaxas. And also you hear Breakpoint this week on the weekends here on Faith Radio. It's recommended listening. The book recommended reading as well. Restoring All Things, God's Audacious Plan to Change the World Through Everyday People. We'll meet some of those everyday people and talk about some lessons we can learn from that. We've got some copies of the book to give away. We'd love to have you sign up for that. Or maybe you've got a story you'd like to tell as well about everyday people making a difference in that redemptive restoration process. 877-933-2484 is our phone number. It's 877-93-FAITH. You can give us a call and sign up for the drawing for the book and join the conversation just ahead.
Build your kingdom here. Let the dark.
Past the hour, talking today with John Stone Street, speaker, sought after speaker, thought leader, a fellow with the Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview. You hear him on Breakpoint and Breakpoint this week. He's co-authored with Warren Cole Smith from World News Group the new book, Restoring All Things, God's Audacious Plan to Change the World Through Everyday People. And it's a book full of real life stories of justice, mercy, love, and forgiveness that we see God at work in his creation and using his church to work out his redemption in the world, and it's recommended reading. We've got some copies to give away. You can sign up for that at 877-93-FAITH. John, I know one of the areas you talk about is just in terms of, you know, kind of the fundamentals of the Christian faith, things that we should have been doing all along, whether it's, you know, caring for the poor or the sick or the widowed and the orphan, those things. But I'm interested you highlight Brian Fickert's book, you know, When Helping Hurts. I'm wondering, you know, is it more important that we do something and maybe not do it well as opposed to not doing anything at all? You've got a great quote in there from William Brown. I'd be interested in your reaction. He says, one person committed to a cause is far more effective than 1,000 who are merely interested.
Yeah. You know, it is a great quote. Bill Brown was one of my mentors in college, and he used to say that. And it just basically, I mean, I think we live in a generation today, I think particularly in millennials, they have a kind of a heightened social awareness, certainly more than us Xers. And I think that's a good thing. But there's also the difference between being interested and being committed. And so, you know, one can feel today like they are actually doing something if they hit like on a Facebook post or, you know, sign a petition or something like that. And that's not the same. I mean, that's something, but that's not the same thing as being committed to a cause. And I think if someone is committed to a cause, they'll be committed not only and especially committed to a cause as a Christian, they'll be committed not only to seeing that cause dealt with, but they'll be committed to the fact of the fundamentals of the faith. I mean, the fundamental convictions that Christians have about life in the world. So, for example, to help the poor, we have certain convictions about what it means to be human, and that has to come into play. In other words, we don't think just human, you know, poor, those that are in poverty or those that are kind of the beneficiaries of our assistance. What we believe is that every human being is made in the image and likeness of God and has a God-given purpose and a design. And so because of that, those who have taken a Christian worldview and applied it to helping those that find themselves in poverty, they've realized that the people themselves have an inherent dignity that's connected with their God-given design, which includes the dignity of creativity and the dignity of self-responsibility and also just the goodness of work. And that's why so many of these Christian organizations, and we tell about so many of them in the book, both locally and internationally, you know, they realize that those that are in poverty are not just beneficiaries of our help, they're actually participants. And when we give them, you know, the classic line is not just a handout, but a hand up, and we actually help them participate in their own freedom and, you know, in their own work and in their own solution, that it actually brings dignity instead of dependence. And, you know, again, you know, Brian Fickert's book, When Helping Hurts, really points to this. I mean, even last year, the year before, you know, Bono, the rocker with U2, said, you know, that what's working around the world is not aid. It's not just giving handouts. It's seeing poverty as more than just being a financial condition. If poverty were just financial, then the answer would be just financial. But poverty can be moral, and it can be relational, and it can be social. It could be, for example, the sort of poverty we have around the world is not the lack of resources. It's limited access to resources, such as capital and the rule of law. And so when Christians bring that to bear, and some of the great work that's being done around the world does that, we tell about one resource that has told so many of these stories, like it's called Poverty Cure from the Acton Institute. It is remarkable to see how, you know, a small micro loan to a woman who wants to open a business or to a man who wants to open a business is more effective in alleviating poverty in a community than kind of huge grants of government aid. Now, there's certainly time you need government aid and you need government safety nets, but we have to understand that each and every person is made in the image and likeness of God. So it's got to be both. It's got to be both heart and head when we seek to address some of the problems that we see in culture.
You know, as we talk about, you know, committed to a cause and social awareness, I mean, obviously, issues of poverty and injustice, those seem, you know, we maybe get those or can sort of everybody can agree on those, but then there are hot button issues and you address those as well, whether it's, you know, abortion or same sex marriage and those things. I mean, maybe we haven't done quite so well on those, but there are still ways that what God is at work, right?
Well, no, there is. And I mean, I think even when you look at, for example, at, you know, part of the issue where it seems like we are, you know, quote unquote, losing the most having to do with really anything sexual. My friend Jay Richards calls them the pelvic issues and whatever, talking about same sex marriage or sexual identity or, you know, things like that. I mean, look, I think that there are still examples of Christians doing remarkable things. But I also think then we also have a lesson from history in the pro-life movement. You know, we're at a moment where tomorrow or Monday, we're going to get a decision from the Supreme Court. Many of us expect, you know, not that this is kind of a hopelessness at all, because I don't think the future of America, the future of the church depends on a Supreme Court decision. But I do think they're probably going to issue some sort of Roe v. Wade, you know, sort of decision about same-sex marriage. Now, you know, you go back to 1972, and, you know, you know, we heard some of the similar things about abortion that we're hearing now about same-sex marriage, you know, that the Supreme Court will settle the issue and that, you know, those who resist are on the wrong side of history. Well, 1972, abortion on demand comes to America. It didn't settle the issue. If there's an issue in America that's not settled, it's abortion, and it hasn't faded away with history. It's not like the younger generation is becoming more pro-choice. Actually, the younger generation is becoming more pro-life. Now, you know, what's amazing about this is that this hasn't happened because of Christian activism at the top of culture alone. Certainly, there are political things that have taken place in the pro-life movement. But you know what? Without the Pregnancy Care Center movement, we wouldn't have seen this remarkable process where even though something is legal, it's becoming more and more unpopular, and it's becoming more and more people are having moral problems with it. So I think we're at the same moment where we don't need to say the Supreme Court's going to settle same-sex marriage and, you know, therefore it's over for America, or therefore we've got to get on the right side of history and change our views. The pro-life movement gives us an example of women who, for example, address the needs of the victims. Just like abortion has its victims, certainly unborn children, women and men as well, grandparents and grandmothers who are left without a grandchild, or aunts and uncles left without a niece or a nephew. And pregnancy care center movements have addressed those. Well, you know what? There are victims of the sexual revolution as well. There's victims, for example, of the transgender movement, where children as young as 8 who are kind of going through natural stages of gender identification are being kind of pushed away from their biological gender into one that's completely made up in their mind. There's going to be victims of this, and the church is going to have an opportunity to bring grace and care to these victims, just like the pro-life movement has done. Pro-life movement has also come up with sophisticated, thoughtful arguments to demonstrate the inherent dignity of all human lives, including those in the womb. Well, we also have researchers and so on that are at work on the sexual issues. There's also apologists in the pro-life community, those that are able to take those great ideas and translate them into usable, repeatable ways so that everyday Christians can, as Chuck Olson used to say, champion the Christian worldview over the backyard fence. Well, that needs to happen as well. So I see great hope even on these controversial issues. There's a lot of work left to be done, which gives me hope that we haven't exhausted all of our efforts. And I think we've got a great example in the pro-life movement that we can mimic.
Good words today from John Stone Street, and I love the focus on grace and care. Well, may it be so. Well, we're talking with John Stone Street about the new book that he's co-authored with Warren Cole Smith called Restoring All Things: God's Audacious Plan to Change the World Through Everyday People. We've got some copies to give away. Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation or sign up for a drawing, it's 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. John Stone Street, you hear him along with Eric Metaxas on Breakpoint. He hosts Breakpoint this week, each weekend here on Faith Radio as well. He's a sought-after speaker, thought leader, a fellow with the Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview, and is joining us today, and we're so appreciative of all the insight that he has to share. We'll hear more in just a moment. Stay tuned for Connecting Faith.
The Far East.
God is at work today. He hasn't left the building. He's actively engaged in fulfilling his promises to restore all things. And the book Restoring All Things provides a lot of real-life stories about justice, mercy, love, and forgiveness all across our communities and neighborhoods, seeing God at work. The book Restoring All Things, subtitled God's Audacious Plan to Change the World Through Everyday People. John Stone Street with us today, a fellow with the Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview. You hear him on a Breakpoint this week. He's authored several books, including Making Sense of Your World, Biblical Worldview, and Same-Sex Marriage, A Thoughtful Approach to God's Design for Marriage. Again, we've got some copies of Restoring All Things to give away as well. I'd love to have you sign up for that and join the conversation at 877-93-FAITH. One of the quotes in the book is from D.L. Moody, who said, "The best way to show that a stick is crooked is not to argue about it or spend time denouncing it, but to lay a straight stick alongside of it." I'd be interested in your reflection on that as it relates to maybe the strategy of how we go about being Christ's ambassadors.
Well, I think, you know, if we think that everything just rests on ideas and arguments, then we're kind of missing how culture moves. And I think I agree with Moody's statement, you know, I think he corrects something important. I do think ideas and arguments still matter, but a lot of times the ideas and arguments that a culture embraces doesn't come through, you know, formal debates. It doesn't come through academic writing. It actually comes through story, and it comes through narrative, and it comes through images. It really, what, you know, we argue this, for example, Sean and I in our book on same-sex marriage, that, you know, this decision that we're about to get didn't come, you know, from the Supreme Court. It didn't come because we actually, you know, had a kind of a rational debate on same-sex marriage and on the definition of marriage. I mean, some of us have tried to, but by and large, the culture was shifted through the imagination, not through the arguments. I mean, it was, you can trace it in pop culture. You can you know, trace it in political culture. The arguments have been absent. It's been the emotions and then the feelings that have been captivated by stories. And of course, what happens is there's a lot of stories, and some stories get left out. That's what's happened in the LGBT issue, that we get a lot of stories for the LGBT movement, but the families that have been broken apart by, you know, a man suddenly deciding after 15 years of marriage that he's gay, as, you know, this story that I heard in Seattle just a couple years ago. I mean, these are the stories that get ignored. And so that's one of the things that we try to do in the book is try to say, you know what, ideas come through being embodied as much as they come through argument. We do need to be willing and able and ready to articulate when those conversations come up, but we can always live out the good ideas. You know, we argue that, for example, you know, when you see, you know, a picture of an ultrasound, and you know, it's really hard to argue this is a blob of flesh once you see it. And it's an idea, but it's an idea that's coming through an image. And Christians, you know, haven't really championed the arts as they once did. And so we have a chapter in there on the arts, for example, and stories of folks like Mako Fujimura, who are in the center of the art world, for example, in New York City, and for Mako, even, you know, internationally, and who are embodying and living out a Christian worldview, communicating Christian ideas about human dignity and morality and so on, without ever actually making an argument. And so I think that's one of the things that we need to take seriously, is that power of story and the power of images and pictures and the imagination in communicating and embracing ideas.
Yeah, I know you are, as a speaker and author and you know, commentator on issues of worldview, I was interested because in the book you quote a theologian, Gresham Machen, talks about false ideas are the greatest obstacles to the reception of the gospel. And he goes on to say that, you know, God desires us as, you know, to get these obstacles at the root. I mean, so there, we do need to kind of evaluate maybe the story behind the story, right? Where the worldview is coming from that brings out these ideas.
No, absolutely. And we just need to understand that ideas are embodied as much as they're argued. I mean, that's really the point. Machen's right. I mean, look, what the reason we're going to get the decision more than likely tomorrow or Monday that we're going to get is because of an idea about the definition of what it means to be human. This is something we clarified in the book on same-sex marriage that we, you know, Sean and I wrote last year, is that what we've undergone in a society is not just a moral slide where, you know, we once, you know, thought these particular forms of sexuality were bad and now we think they're good. It's that we now think that the most defining essential characteristic of a human person is one's sexual inclinations and sexual choices. In other words, that any sort of a metaphysical understanding of human dignity, that we're made in the image of God, that, you know, that we're morally free creatures who make decisions, this has been replaced, whereas our dignity is tied to our sexuality almost exclusively. Now, again, there were people who articulated these ideas of the sexual revolution, you know, folks like, you know, Alfred Kinsey and Michel Foucault, and most of us that would have never known about them. But it was Hugh Hefner who took Alfred Kinsey's ideas and then embodied them in an art form called Playboy. And that changed literally the way America thought about sexuality. And we know that kind of the images that were hidden on the back shelf in the 50s are on the front page of Cosmo and the grocery store aisles today, and on billboards and the hypersexualization of things like, Victoria's Secret and other things that are kind of integrated into business. So these are very much ideas. And this is exactly, if you're going to help someone become a Christian and they don't know that there's such a thing as moral norms or moral absolutes, it's going to be very hard to convince them that they're a sinner in need of a savior. And so this is the sort of thing that Machen's talking about, from early in the 1900s. As he's saying that these ideas are great obstacles to the hear, to make up a word here, to the hearability of the gospel. People who have kind of been shaded in their worldview by bad ideas can't even actually hear the categories we're using. And that's why we, in turn, have to communicate ideas. We need to argue ideas. And you know what? We need to actually embody those ideas as well.
We'll talk more about, how do we embody those ideas in a moment. But long as we're kind of on this topic of, the sort of sexual identity, Susan had called in and just wanted to know what you think about for victims of transgender issues, the high-profile people like Bruce Jenner, their family, his fame and wealth, the barriers to people needing the grace of God. I mean, can they still recognize that they're victims of this?
Yeah, that's right. And that's one of the things that I think is the clearest thing we can learn from the pro-life movement is that we care about ideas, not just because we care about ideas, but because ideas have consequences for actual people. And people can be self-deceived into being a victim. People can be kind of just victimized because of bad ideas in a culture. And that's what the gospel has. The gospel has hope and redemption and restoration, like the church mobilized around helping the victims of abortion, we can also mobilize and help the other victims of the sexual revolution. Aborted children and women in crisis pregnancies, they're targets of the sexual revolution's bad ideas. So are people who are struggling with gender identity, and so are people that are struggling with sexual orientation issues. And for us to go along with the deception, to go along with a bad idea, isn't loving. And at the same time, for us to pretend to not see that someone's deeper inherent dignity is actually rooted in their identity as made in the image of God is also an unloving thing to do. But Christianity gives us the categories, and it gives us the source of our love and our hope, and we can actually help these victims.
Mm-hmm. John Stonestreet, co-author of a great new book called Restoring All Things, God's Audacious Plan to Change the World Through Everyday People. It's from Baker Books. John, sought-after speaker and fellow with the Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview. You hear him regularly on Breakpoint and Breakpoint this week. And you alluded to the fact that, as Christians, we need to embody these important truths, that we it's not just about, fighting for truth and ideals, but it's living them out. And I was interested that at the end of each chapter, you provide some action points. And as I read through, these 14 or 15 topics from, capitalism to race to trafficking to education, all these things, but, each one could probably have the same action point: establish a mentor relationship or personally get to know someone who, fill in the blank. Talk about the importance of relationship maybe as a means of influence.
Well, yeah, no, it is relationship, but it isn't just relationship. And I think that's probably the lowest hanging fruit is to actually, be personal. And that's why, by the way, local activism, that's why the church is a better resource than the government in dealing with a lot of these issues. And that's, the government has recognized this throughout history. And that's why we have, for example, the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives. And the reason is this: it's the Catholic principle at work here is what we call subsidiarity, and there's a kind of a similar vision from Abraham Kuyper in what's called sphere sovereignty. But subsidiarity teaches that all things equal, the one most local to the problem is best addressed to solve the problem, right? So if somebody is sick, first of all, the parent is the quickest one to deal with a cold. But if a parent can't do it, it goes to the next local institution and the next local institution. Poverty is the same way. Government's one-size-fits-all war on poverty 50 years later hasn't really lifted, actually, percentage-wise, anyone out of poverty. We spent, you know, trillions of dollars, and we don't have anything to show for it. But I tell you, and the reason is because the reasons for poverty have to be personally known, and the government can't get personal. I mean, that's why the government, you know, screens every passenger that goes through the airport the same way, whether they're an 85-year-old grandmother or they're someone, you know, from a high-risk Middle Eastern area or something like that. I mean, they can't make distinctions like that. And that's why local solutions are always better. And so the personal touch is absolutely indispensable on almost all of these issues. But there's also systemic problems. And that's really – there's examples – I mean, let's take – you know, just go into the arts. I mean, there's lots of examples about this. But the systemic issue of the arts is, well, what's beautiful? And you know, right now, systemically, the arts have been kind of hijacked by an entertainment industry that prefers popularity over depth or beauty. And, you know, it's more important to look good than to be good. And so these are systemic issues that Christians can actually address by producing better art and also by producing better systems to which art can deliver to everyday people to make them think deeper about life. You deal with, you know, poverty. If you know, you can care about the poor in a local community, but you can't lift regions out of poverty if the entire nation does not have a clear sense of the rule of law. You know, without the rule of law, you can't build trust. Without trust, you can't have capitalism. And so, which, as many people have noted, including Bono, has lifted more people out of poverty than any government program. So you have to deal with both the personal and the systemic.
Great insight today from John Stone Street. Learning a lot. Hope you are as well. Glad to have you listening in, and glad John could join us for some conversation about the new book he's co-written with Warren Cole Smith from World Magazine, World News Group, called Restoring All Things, God's Audacious Plan to Change the World Through Everyday People. From Baker, John, sought after speaker, thought leader, and teacher. He's a speaker and a fellow with the Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview. And then we're going to ask John maybe for a few of his favorite examples of God's restoration of the world through the book Restoring All Things, coming up in a moment. And also a story about an elderly lady that he encountered some years ago, how it changed his life. Stay tuned for that. And you'd like to sign up for a copy of the book, it's 877-933-2484. Today, John Stone Street, speaker, fellow with the Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview, author of several books, including the new one with Warren Cole Smith from World News Group and the World Magazine. It's called Restoring All Things, God's Audacious Plan to Change the World Through Everyday People. And there are lots of stories, as we mentioned, there's, you know, maybe 14 or 15 sort of issues from, you know, capitalism to trafficking to education to, you know, the disabled, and the list goes on. But John, I'm wondering if maybe you have a favorite example or two of as you maybe encountered some of these stories, and then maybe how they impacted you as you learn more about how God is at work in everyday people.
Well, no, I mean, there's so many stories there in the book. It's even hard for me to choose. I mean, I love the story of CareNet. I mean, I love the fact that women all across America, you know, answered the challenges of abortion. That to me is my personal favorite, really, because my mother was involved in that movement for 10 years, as was my wife. And I just watch it. I get to speak at these, you know, fundraisers for these organizations. And I just think to myself, there's not a better example of making a difference in the world in the face of grave evil than the pro-life movement. And particularly what CareNet and the pregnancy care centers have done, because really one of the main arguments for abortion was this argument that, well, there's no one to take care of these women, there's no one to take care of these children. And, you know, if we have, you know, if we don't have abortion, people are going to be trapped and they're not going to have any help and so on. And what happened is that women all across America, when political change didn't take place, they banded together, and, you know, in communities, and said, you know, well, we'll take care of these women, we'll take care of these children, and you know, and I get to speak at these events, and I meet these women who, almost all of them are Christian, and these every community. I mean, from big cities like New York City, Eric Metaxas, my colleague, his wife runs a crisis pregnancy center there in New York City, to little towns. I was in Vidalia, Georgia earlier this year with another group. And you meet these women, and you would say, well, do you know you're part of a culture-wide movement that's kind of shifting the way culture sees the dignity of human life? And they would say, no, not at all. I'm just trying to help that woman. But the net result of these thousands of women helping individuals is really moving the lever on culture in a really powerful way. So that's an example. I also think of those that are, you know, helping those out of poverty. We have four or five local stories of organizations that are putting people to work, teaching them job skills, and then finding them employment. And, you know, I think of, you know, what Chuck Colson did with Prison Fellowship and raising that organization up to deal with a significant problem of, you know, the prison population exploding. You know, now, you know, the work of Chuck Colson is carried on through Prison Fellowship and Justice Fellowship, where not only are they helping deal with the what we call the recidivism rate, whereas, you know, the number of people who leave prison, how many of them go back, it's epidemic, and they're helping readjust you know, those that are incarcerated back into society, which is so important, because a lot of times when it comes to crime, we think we ask the wrong first question. The first question is, how do we get bad people off the street? Well, yeah, there's the next question, which is, how do we return good people back to our society? And that's the sort of thing that Prison Fellowship had tackled, not to mention the Angel Tree program. Unbelievable. Whereas parents and children are separated in the family unit, which is the breakdown of the family unit is one of the great indicators of crime and causes of crime. And then when people are incarcerated, that family unit breaks down. And that's why so many children of prisoners become incarcerated themselves. Well, Angel Tree helps bridge the gap in the relationship between parents and children every year at Christmas by making sure that children are not forgotten by their parents, and also using that as an opportunity for the gospel. I mean, look, the stories go on and on and on. I got to admit, I kind of felt, you know, this biblical story where Elijah, after Mount Carmel, is threatened by Jezebel, and he runs out into the wilderness, and he says, I'm the only one, I'm the only one. And God shows up and says, you don't even know about these 5,000 prophets over here who haven't bowed their knee to Baal. And I think to myself, that's kind of what I thought and what I felt after putting this book together and seeing these stories. You kind of think there's not that much going on. And I didn't even know about these dozens and dozens and dozens of stories of people doing amazing things.
Are there maybe a principle or two that we can learn from the examples that you've presented, but maybe ways to be effective and winsome? I mean, are there some maybe key similarities in all those?
Yeah, let me give you three. I mean, the first thing is what we talked about. Our attitude has to be one of hope. And so we have to consistently remember and remind each other that the cultural moment is a moment. The story of the world is the story of the creation and restoration of all things. As again, what Jesus says and as John quotes in his Revelation, behold, I make all things new. We've got to believe that God is reconciling the world to himself and has given us the ministry of reconciliation. Hope is the story of the world, not this cultural moment. The second thing is that aim for the middle. We need to be informed, but being informed is not the same thing as being engaged. And so we need to be not only informed but engaged, and aiming at the middle is important. And then the third thing is the practical stuff. We have four questions in the book. Three of the questions kind of fall out of the biblical story, I think, pretty cleanly. And then a fourth question, I think, comes from what it means to be made in the image of God. But we encourage Christians, as they look at their local communities, their own spheres of influence, their own opportunities, to ask these four questions. First of all, what's good that we can protect and promote? Christians should champion the good, the true, and the beautiful, whether it's art, whether it's religious liberty, whether it's human dignity. We should always be about championing the good. Secondly, what's missing that we can contribute? Great stories throughout history of believers who just look, and because of their God-given creativity, their God-given care and entrepreneurship, were able to say, you know what, if this were only invented, or if this idea, if this law were in place, one, you know, we remember, for example, the Magna Carta, which we celebrated the 800th anniversary, this idea that the king is responsible to the law, the king doesn't make the law. I mean, what a remarkable idea that the world was missing that was contributed. What is missing that we can contribute? The third one is what's evil that we can stop. Sometimes Christians find themselves in the flow of history, standing there yelling, stop, stop, stop. You know, kind of like that character in Pilgrim's Progress. Wilberforce said slavery must stop. And today's one of the stories we have in the book, Lila Rose, great activist for unborn children. Abortion must stop. Those that are dealing with sex trafficking, a whole bunch of organizations. Reggie Littlejohn looking at forced abortions in China and the denigration of women in China. This has to stop. And then finally, what is broken that we can restore? And I think the most obvious answer to that is there's a bunch of relationships, relationships between fathers and children, between husbands and wives, between Christians and their community. Christians should be the ones reconciling relationships. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, God was in Christ reconciling men to himself and has given us the ministry of reconciliation. So those of us that are reconciled are to become agents of reconciliation. And that has to do with restoring and redeeming and renewing things that are broken.
We got a couple minutes left. I don't know if you can tell the story about Miss Buckner in a couple minutes, but you closed the book with that. Say, tell more about her.
Well, no, it's hard to tell that in just a couple minutes. Warren Smith and I both wanted to end with a personal story of someone who just cared for their environment. When I was in the ninth grade, I was kind of a hypocritical, snotty-nosed Christian school kid who didn't take my faith very seriously. And was much more interested in things that I shouldn't have been. But I found myself at the doorstep of an 89-year-old woman who was shut in from our church. She couldn't leave her house. And the impact that that woman had on me for the next 8 years is just really remarkable. It's hard to explain. I tell the story in the book, but she prayed for me. She challenged me. She just kind of reoriented my vision of reality. And again, 89-year-old woman couldn't leave her house, but she was faithful to whoever came and knocked on her door and just made a remarkable difference. The end of the story is a few years ago, I went back to that community, spoke at the graduation of that same Christian high school where I graduated from, and I told the story of Miss Buckner. And all across the audience of 700-800 people, there were people with tears in their eyes, nodding their heads. They had known her too. And I suddenly realized that this woman who couldn't leave her house impacted an awful lot of lives. In fact, she impacted an entire community because she was faithful to do what she could do with the people she came into contact with, which, of course, was always in the confines of her own little home. And so it's just a remarkable story of what somebody can actually do when they take seriously their responsibility to be faithful where they're planted.
And, she obviously had a significant prayer life, and that probably is where we should leave it as well, that, we all can start with prayer and pray through all the issues as well, all the way along.
I have no idea to this day what that woman prayed me into and out of, and she just did it. And I think that is absolutely the case. And I think some believers who really have a limited sphere of influence, at least they think they do, because they see kind of national things going on or whatever, but they're faithful to pray. They should not underestimate one bit this unbelievable tool of the Holy Spirit to change lives and to change things. And prayer does. And Miss Buckner is proof of that in my life.
John Stonestreet, really encouraging us today. Insightful and encouraging, hopeful conversation as we're reminded again of God's audacious plan to change the world through everyday people. The book we're referencing is called Restoring All Things. John Stonestreet, co-author with Warren Cole Smith. John's speaker and fellow with Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview. And look forward to hearing you again on Breakpoint the next time. And Breakpoint this week, I always enjoy the opportunity to hear what you have to say. John, thanks for carving out some time today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You've been listening to Connecting Faith. If you'd like to hear a part of the show again or pass it on to a friend, you can also find the interviews posted on our website. It's myfaithradio.com, and then click on the Connecting Faith show page.